Hey y'all, how's it going? Well, good. Oh, I mean, oh, that's too bad. You're watching the Hagel-Dempsey testimony on C-SPAN too, huh? Yeah, I know, it sucks, but what are you going to do? All right. I got news and I got interviews. It's libertarian foreign policy mostly, of course, here on the show. Matthew Ho is going to be here to talk about Iraq War 3. Well, in Syria, too. And Marcy Wheeler's going to be on to talk about so-called NSA reform. Yeah. Come on. You knew anything called NSA reform was going to be too good to be true, right? Of course, yeah. Well, Marcy knows better, so she's going to say it out loud for us there. And, man, I'm hoping I get Jeff Stein on. I just finished reading his new piece about, he's got a whole bunch of, I don't know, four or five different CIA agents admitting what a crappy job they're doing vetting Syrian rebels. Oh, yes, they're all very moderate, these rebels. And, well, get old Jeff Stein on the National Security beat there, see if I can get him back on the show. And then, you know, if I could, I'd like to ask him about the Harmon story again, too. That came up with MJ Rosenberg on the show yesterday, and yet it was still only half the story. I tried to say it fast. Not sure if you remember that scandal, but it was a good one. Israeli spies trying to work to see if they could get their asset in the U.S. Congress a job as the chair of the House Intelligence Committee. I know it sounds made up, but no, it's Jeff Stein's scoop. And all Jane Harmon, the burnt spy, had to say about it was, well, the burnt asset, not the agent, but the asset of the agent. All she had to say about it was, well, I'll challenge you to a race. A foot race, Jeff Stein. So put on your best, you know, Nike jumpsuit and let's go have a race. She was guilty. She was caught red-handed by the National Security Agency. And it was funny, too, because she tried to spin it. I won't tell you the whole story again in case I can get him on the show again today, but she tried to spin it like, oh my God, NSA spying. I mean, the nerve for them to be spying on me. And yet, she was the world champion of defending NSA spying. That's part of the story. Part of the quid pro quo going on in the story was her being a leading defender of NSA lawless, secret, covert, you know, the Stellar Wind program. She was a huge defender of that. Well, she wasn't, the NSA wasn't breaking the law when they were spying on Jane Harmon. They weren't spying on Jane Harmon. They were spying on an Israeli spy. And he was on the phone with Jane Harmon. So, you see how it wasn't the NSA tapping an American, even with probable cause or anything else. Beyond a shadow of a doubt level of anything. No, they were doing their job tapping an Israeli spy's phone, and then they heard him telling Jane Harmon what he would do for her if she would only do for him. So anyway, if you didn't hear the show yesterday, then, boy, you must be so curious. I got an email out to Stein, so I mostly want to talk to him about vetting Syrian rebels. It's a really great story that he wrote here for Newsweek. But I also want to ask him about the Harmon story, because of course it's about Haim Sabin. Well, it's not about him, but he's part of the story. Haim Sabin, who of course is in the news and was the subject of the interview with MJ Rosenberg yesterday. He's he is one of the leading donors and most influential financial pieces of the Democratic Party's game in this country. They are absolutely relying on him. And he's as Likudnik as Benjamin Netanyahu. And he's Hillary Clinton's champion. She's his. And, yeah. He's why you wonder sometimes, maybe you read something from the Brookings Institution and you think, huh, I always thought these guys were kind of center-left, but Bill Kristol could have written this. Well, that's why. It's Haim Sabin's money there. Paying for little Bill Kristol clones all over D.C. Including Hillary Clinton, yeah. All right, anyway. So, yeah, hopefully we'll hear from Stein, and he'll do the show. Now that I think about it, I have to admit, he always takes a couple hours to get back to me, so we might not. We're going to try and work that out. All right. But then, yeah, also tons of news. And let's start today, for the rest of this segment, with the Oklahoma City bombing. Now, as you may know, Timothy McVeigh had a lot of help from a lot of Nazis when he bombed that building back in 1995. And the only thing about those Nazis were many of them were flipped state's witnesses and or past, current, future, well, not future, past and current informants for the FBI. And in fact, including a man named André Strassmeier, who is a German national who most probably was actually not even really a Nazi at all, but was just an undercover cop, an agent provocateur, rather than, you know, an actual Nazi who'd gotten arrested for something and had been pressured to flip in exchange for a lighter sentence, that kind of thing. He was just the put-on man, seemingly. Books and books have been written about this, and it ain't no truth or crap. It's real. In fact, if you have very high standards for how centrist and official your sources must be, I'll ask you to look at YouTube at the New America Foundation, which is as center-left as Barack Obama, okay? It is the Barack Obama Institute. That's all it is. Steve Clemens and the New America Foundation, Peter Bergen, very acceptable Democrat, CNN expert on terrorism, a man who interviewed bin Laden back in 1996. They did a whole thingamajig, you know, up there on a stage with the audience and all that, presentation, with the author, co-author of a book called Oklahoma City. His name's Andrew Gumbel, and he's a British journalist. And again, perfectly center-left, Washington, D.C. acceptable. No truth or nonsense about it whatsoever. And it's just journalism in a book. And he tells the whole story, and it's right there at the New America Foundation. Nothing kooky or crazy about it. Go look at it. Andrew Gumbel, Peter Bergen, New America Foundation, Oklahoma City. Those are all the keywords you could possibly need if you want to take a look at that. But anyway, so here's the thing about it, and here's how so much information has come out about the Oklahoma City bombing. In the summer of 1995, federal agents murdered a man in custody at a federal holding facility near Tulsa, Oklahoma, a man named Kenneth Trenadue. And then it turned out that the reason that they did probably was because it was a case of mistaken identity. They thought that he was Richard Guthrie, who was very likely John Doe number two, or one of the people seen with McVeigh in the days before the bombing or the day of the bombing, and was almost certainly a co-conspirator there, or virtually certainly a co-conspirator in the bombing. So this guy, Kenneth, had the same massive upper body build, the same red hair, the same handlebar mustache, the same dragon tattoo on his right arm, the same damn red pickup truck. I mean, you talk about mistaken identity. The devil got to this guy. It's just not fair. He had to be Richard Guthrie. He matched up in 10 ways or something. Six. So they tortured him to death because he wouldn't admit he was Richard Guthrie. Well, he wasn't. Anyway, what happened was his brother's a lawyer from Utah named Jesse Trenadue, and Jesse doesn't play along with that, and he filed all the correct paperwork in all the right ways where they could not cremate the body that claimed was a suicide, and Jesse got his brother's body and proved that he was murdered and has been suing the government ever since. So here's a man who has no connection to the Oklahoma City story at all other than he saw it on TV like the rest of us, right? Except that somebody murdered his brother. And then it turns out the reason they murdered his brother was all tied up with the Oklahoma City bombing. And so he's been suing and suing and suing, and they settled out of court and paid him more than $1 million for what they did to his brother. He's continuing to sue. And damn, I went on too long about part of that story there and ran out of time for this segment. I'll pick it back up on the other side of this break. But he's suing right now for the video footage, and he's accusing the FBI of witness tampering, and the judge seems to agree with him. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all. Well, I talked to Jeff Stein, and he's busy. I'm going to try again and see if I can get him on the show tomorrow. But since he's not going to be on, I'll tell you the Jane Harmon story in a minute. But let me finish up on Jesse Trinidoux. So here's this guy. He's just some lawyer from Utah, and then the feds murder his brother because they think he's Richard Lee Guthrie, a probable co-conspirator in the Oklahoma City bombing. So he's been suing the crap out of him ever since, and he's proved that there are videos and that they have videos of the truck pulling up to the curb, being parked, and the truck going off. And these videos, at least they have, he has proven in Secret Service records that at least one of these videos depicts John Doe 2 in the truck and get out of the truck with McVeigh and go ahead on. So he's suing about that, and he has a source, and his source is a former FBI agent. And hell, I ought to open up all the PDFs here. I had them. Let me get all the names here and stuff. I have them on my desktop here. Let me see. So the guy's name is John. Anyway, point is, doesn't matter. The point is, he's got an FBI agent informant, and the FBI agent has told him that he saw McVeigh with Andre Strassmeyer in Texas before the attack, and other details. The guy's name is Matthews, John Matthews. Okay? And so he has come forward, and he has told Jesse Trinidoux all this stuff about Operation PatCon, which is FBI speak for Patriot Conspiracy, meaning, I guess, kind of double meaning, like they're the Patriot Movement conspiracy kooks, but also they are a conspiracy because you know how government thinks. Anybody who has a group of people who agree with each other about how much they don't like the government, that's a conspiracy from their point of view. And, of course, these guys were neo-Nazi, racist, murderer, bank robber, lunatics. And so, yeah, they were conspirators in various crimes at the same time, too. So, anyway, that was the name of the operation, PatCon. And it was about infiltrating these right-wing militia groups and Nazi groups. Now, you might think, yeah, infiltrate the Klan and make sure that they're not killing people and stuff like that. You know, whatever, fine. Okay, but don't create a bunch of white supremacist gangs that never existed just to create a bunch of crimes, to create a bunch of business for your police agency, please, which is a lot of what happened here. And now, but to the point, the guy didn't show up. And I guess, I don't know the technicalities of the law in Utah and federal district court rules and this and that, but I guess the guy was not subpoenaed. He did not have to show up. But he's forwarded on the emails and shown where FBI agents gave him advice. Yeah, you don't have to go. And that's tampering with the witness. They're the defendants here in this lawsuit. And the judge, his name is Wallops, I believe, which is kind of a fun little thing there. He keeps walloping the FBI. He's not impressed by them. He's not impressed by the DOJ. He doesn't really care what they say. He's a federal judge, and one of them who I guess is full of himself enough that his ambition can be made to check ambition. And he just does not carry water for the federals on this case, and he never has for years on end. He has been a good judge out there in Utah, taking the side of this heroic lawyer who, after all, is just defending the legacy of his murdered brother. And anyway, so they are liars, and they're witness tamperers. And here, I guess, here, I'm sitting here talking a bunch of smack. I ought to prove it. How much time do I have? Let me read to you from, I'll have to flip through real quick and find the email where they tell him, or he paraphrases what they told him anyway, that he doesn't have to go. Some of this has, you know, extraneous information about some of the stuff that he knows about the PatCon operation. Let's see. So, John, the deal is John has a handler named Don, and some of this is the communication between him and his, maybe he was an informant himself of some kind, or no, I think he was an FBI agent, but it was his boss. Don was his supervisor. And so, yeah, here it is, Donald Jarrett and John Matthews. And so, so here they are talking, and I'm sorry, I don't have the exact PDF queued up here. But here they are talking about, here he is emailing back and forth with his handler about, hey, what's your recollection of these Nazis and who knew who back then and whatever? And his handler's saying, yeah, I agree with you. That sounds plausible to me. Tell me more, this kind of thing. And then, but hang on, I'm trying to find the part where they tell him that, yeah, if you're not subpoenaed, you don't have to go. It's in here, and it's certainly quoted in, I think this is the one. Yeah, see? Okay. I did not want to testify and did not want to... Oh, well, let me just start over. My name is John Matthews. I'm sending you all this, for I want the record straight. I talked with Don Jarrett. He was my handler for the FBI and now a friend about this court case. Like, we both agree, I had nothing to do with the Oklahoma City bombing or the tapes. And by the way, no one ever said he did. I did not want to testify, and I did not want to get caught in a crossfire with both sides. Seeing as there was no subpoena, I did not have to show up. If I took a trip, no one could find me to give me a subpoena. Don told me, Don, his FBI agent handler, Don told me we should inform the FBI in SLC, that's Salt Lake City, and let them know what I was going to do. That's how I got in touch with Agent Adam Quirk. We played tag for a week on the phones. I told him of what me and Don talked about. He agreed with me that if there was no subpoena, I did not have to show up. But if I got one, I would have to show up. So in other words, this FBI agent, the guy being sued, clarified for this potential witness against him who was concerned and needed to understand better that, no, you do not have to go if there's no subpoena. At this point, you've only been invited. Go ahead, take a vacation if you feel like, apparently. I told him of what me and Don talked about. He agreed with me that if there was no subpoena, I did not have to show up. But if I got one, I would have to show up. We also talked about if I did not remember something, just say you don't recall. It was my understanding he was going to let the court know I was not going to show up. Roger Charles and Jesse Trinity both called me and I told them I was not going to testify. That Agent Adam Quirk was supposed to have told the court. He admitted that, yeah, this FBI agent was going to handle it for me. He says, that's how this mess got started. I've asked no one to send any letters to the court on my behalf. And then he says in all capitals, fair enough point to make, even though no one ever said this, but still he wants to clarify, no one from the FBI or DOJ has made any threats to me or my family, he says. Hope this clears up everything for everyone. Fine, they didn't have to threaten him or his family. The fact that they helped advise him to not go to court is jury tampering, and they're guilty. They're guilty. And the judge seems to think so, too. Another break. Right back. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's my show. Hey, if you want to join up the chat room, it's scotthorton.org/chat. You want to follow me on Twitter, it's /Scott Horton Show. You want to sign up for the podcast feed of the interview archives or the whole show archives, it's all there at iTunes and Stitcher. All right. First guest on the show today is Matthew Ho, formerly a Marine and then a State Department official. He made headlines, I believe, back in 2009, resigning from the State Department, complaining about the surge plan, which was certain to not work and simply be a sacrifice of soldiers and Afghan lives for nothing and that kind of thing, and has also done a lot of work on, well, I guess his own, and helping others with their post-traumatic stress from their times in the war zones as well. Very notable to say. He's at CIPonline.org. That's the Center for International Policy, CIPonline.org. And you can find his article archive also at MatthewHo.com and at the Huffington Post. Welcome back to the show, Matthew. How are you doing?
Good, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us on the show today. I guess I have to assume you've been watching a bit of Hagel and Dempsey this morning testifying, I believe, before the House Armed Services Committee, correct?
Actually,
no, I should have checked with you. Yeah.
Yeah. We've got some, construction and some contracting work going on. So yeah, I was
well,
gonna
yeah, don't ask questions you don't know the answer to, Horton. That's the lesson there. All right. Anyway, you already know what they're saying, or I'll tell you that they're denying the CNN story that there's any kind of review of their Syria policy. But, I know you've seen the CNN story that, the Obama administration has decided that they can't defeat Jefferson Davis without first taking out Abraham Lincoln. I'm not sure how that makes any sense at all. And I know Abraham Lincoln has killed far more people than Bashar al-Assad has ever killed, so it's an unfair comparison. But anyway, what do you think about the discrepancy here in the policy in Syria, where we're supposedly training up an army of 5,000 to fight every other faction on both sides of the civil war that's been raging there for 3 years?
Yeah, it's quite mind-boggling, isn't it, Scott? You read these things or you hear these things or you just observe them. I mean, as time, you know, goes on with this, it's like we've been living in this bizarre dream for the last 13 years or, you know, where up is down and forward is back and white is black and things just don't make any sense. And, so it's hard to say anything more profound or more eloquent about what's going on in Washington DC other than these guys really have no idea what they're doing. And they're just trying to keep this, vestige of American empire. And you know, they're trying to keep the trappings of American power around the world. You know, they're caught up in the romance of being wartime presidents and senators and policymakers, and they're enabled by a military industrial complex, which we spend about $1 trillion a year on. I mean, so I think what we're seeing here where they don't know what they're doing is just exactly that. They don't know what they're doing.
Well, and you know, I don't know, man. I mean, part of it is, well, okay. I'm sure you're at least somewhat aware of the history of the Oded Yanan plan and the clean break strategy, what David Wolmser wrote about coping with crumbling states. And there are many who say that, you know, come on, all this bumbling is the plan. Even Greenwald, who's pretty, you know, center left kind of an official kind of a guy. I mean, he's great on the Bill of Rights, but he's pretty conventional in most of his politics, said, come on, this is all on purpose. Creating more chaos, more terrorists to fight indefinitely for the military-industrial complex, just as you say. You could point to, and I'm torn on this myself, Matthew, so I'm still really just trying to provoke a response out of you here with this. I mean, I can point to 1,000 bad decisions that they made in Iraq. I can talk about Sanchez and Casey and the wars that they waged and whatever there, you know, and with the best of them and their stupidity, you know, in that sense. And yet, yeah, you know, I kind of got to concede that the neocons and the Likudniks have gotten what they said they wanted, which is just unending chaos. And if it's Maybe it's not a black and white issue, but like on the map, it's solid green versus striped green on the legend there, Sunni Shia, and America is fighting on both sides of the sectarian war. And that's not even really oversimplifying it, right? It's pretty easy to identify the contradictions in the American policy. So at some point, it does. Doesn't it kind of start stretching credulity to think they're really so stupid that they still now, for 11 years straight, are fighting for Iran in Iraq, but against them everywhere else?
I think a lot of this is balanced with the notion that our domestic political understanding of the world is so black and white, is so we're good, they're bad. And I just go, you know, I go back to, Lyndon Johnson's decision to escalate the Vietnam War, you know, the deliberations over it and just coming to the realization that he had to do it for, you know, because the men on Capitol Hill would come after him if he didn't do it. If he didn't stand up to communism. And I think that's a lot of it here. I think it's just, members of Congress, the guy in the Oval Office, just wanting to be tougher than the next guy. I just go in terms of what they think they're going to accomplish or what they're going to accomplish. And I just see the neoconservatives and the whole, the folks who are involved with PNAC and then, what I saw in the government and at fairly high levels, both on the civilian side and on the military side, and actually in both administrations, was this notion that and this understanding of themselves as being on the right side of history, that they were imbued with something special, that they were better than others, and that their plan was going to work for no other reason that they were the ones who were doing it. As well then too, I think they really thought that what they were trying to accomplish was this religious pursuit of American exceptionalism. I mean, I just recall when I was in Iraq my first time in the Coalition Provisional Authority and seeing your people there talking about our occupation of Iraq, what we were doing there in such righteous terms, and then hearing as well from them how when we're finished here, we're going to go, you know, the question is, do we go right or do we go left? Do we go to Syria or do we go to Iran? And just the lack of humility and the lack of understanding of the reality. So, I kind of keep coming back to to it that this is a plan that comes out of this notion that America is the indispensable nation, as Madeleine Albright said, right? And that we have a duty to liberate others and to make others in our image. That is taken pretty seriously by some policymakers. And now we're at the point when after that plan has been enacted, there's no way to get out of it without giving up the appearance of America losing her empire. And that's just where I come back. And then, of course, that's all enabled by this $1 trillion defense, you know, national security, homeland security, intelligence, development, complex that provides all the data, all the analysis, all the assessments, all the talking heads, all the guys with PhDs to make this sound like it actually can work, will work. I mean, certainly you have political generals who want to, advance their careers, so they're not going to speak out against a policy that has gone awry, that is not going to work. And the same thing on the civilian side. The civilians want to climb.
All right, fine, but I still want their lies to at least make a little bit of sense, you know, on their face. Not on examination, of course, but just I'd like them to sound plausible at first, at least. We'll be right back with Matthew Ho in just a sec, y'all. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Matthew Ho about Iraq War 3, although that's not good enough because, of course, it includes eastern Syria. I don't think it really is eastern Syria. I don't think it really is western Iraq. I think the Islamic State is a place, and that the independence of those former political units are, I think all that is irreversible at this point. It's ridiculous, really, to continue to call it Iraq and Syria when it's the war against the Islamic State is what it is. They control, what, half a dozen major cities and a hell of a lot of smaller towns and that kind of thing. Enough of what to call this horrible thing. Before we move on, I kind of wanted to find a little bit of middle ground there where maybe instead of a grand design that works, or just, bumbling stupidity, maybe you have really incompetent malevolence. And they didn't want chaos. They wanted it to be easy. They thought it would be easy and they would rule everything. And what are a bunch of civilians going to do about it compared to the power of the American military? That's why they didn't really even worry about what Iraq was going to be like after the occupation. Cause whatever sock puppets we choose, we'll work it out or whatever. It'll be fine, kind of idea. And yet they just really suck at being evil, aggressive imperialists. And I think that's probably, the best description of the situation. If you think about, as you referred to there, kind of their idea of how Iraq was going to be at first. Oh yeah, we're going to have 60 bases forever. And the Iraqi people are all just going to kiss our feet and bow down before us. And we're just going to have our way there from now on. It didn't work out that way because there was Ayatollah here and suicide bomber there, and they didn't get along and caused some problems. And speaking of which, this is one thing I've been meaning to ask you for a long time, Matthew, is about what you said about your experience in the rise of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq and their Badr Corps, who, Jonathan Landay said on the radio show a few weeks back, or I don't know, a couple months back now, that he was there in Kurdistan when Skiri came across the border from Iran just after the invasion. And there they were, and what was going to happen to him? George Bush put him in power. And this is in the news now because there's an Amnesty report about them torturing and killing people. And I think there was a Reuters special report about them torturing, killing people. The Badr Brigade and the Asaib al-Haq and the other Iranian-backed militias. I was wondering if you could educate us a little bit about the history of these groups and who these guys really are.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these organizations were composed of Shia exiles from Iraq that were being harbored and housed by the Iranian regime. In that decades long clash between those two nations. And so certainly just like Lande said, I wasn't there in 2003, in our invasion, but certainly had a lot of friends and who were, both the Marines and the Army as they pushed north out of Kuwait. And, multiple guys have said, yeah, they were here before we were. The Iranians were in these towns and cities before we got there. That they came across the border before we did and, made their presence known, solidified gains for themselves, entrenched themselves. And of course they did. Why wouldn't they? But certainly, yeah, these militias, then had power in Baghdad, in many ways because we gave it to them, in many ways because we gave them the money, in many ways because they had political figures attached to these militias who, if you could kind of think of it as the difference between political wings and military wings, so say maybe the difference between like Sinn Féin and the actual, Irish Republican Army in terms of the diplomats versus the trigger pullers. But certainly, yeah, I mean, in my case, I saw us pass money to Siri. The thing I had direct witness of was writing over $20 million in cash. It was, money from the seized Iraqi assets program, the oil for food program, money that had been provided by the United Nations to CPA to administer. And then what I saw was us just transfer it just directly over to Siri. And then within Siri, as you mentioned, Scott, you had the militia, you had the botter brigade. And, you know, these are very extreme, very Islamist, but also very, very corrupt, very thuggish. They don't represent anything good in any part of society. So what our war there did, our occupation, our quote-unquote liberation did, was allow these groups that were just as bad as Saddam Hussein's people to get back into Iran and to get positions of power very quickly, because this vacuum had occurred. And then once they were in these positions, to receive political and financial support from the United States.
Yeah. Well, now, correct me if I'm wrong. Is it the case that these guys were always avowedly separatists, that they never really wanted to try, and they had the 60% majority in the country, but they never really wanted to try to rule and conquer all these predominantly Sunni areas? They just wanted Bush to use the Army and the Marine Corps to give them Baghdad. Because I remember Muqtada al-Sadr, who was actually not an Iraqi traitor, but who stayed in Iraq the whole time, who had, you know, grassroots support at least, and he would constantly denounce Abdulaziz al-Hakim and say, hey, man, you know, we should be creating an alliance with the Sunni Arabs in the name of Iraqi nationalism against the Iranians and the Americans. What is it with you? And, of course, Skiri had the backing of the Americans and the Iranians, so they were in the catbird seat, not Sadr. But he was constantly denouncing them for basically agreeing with the Israelis. Let's split up Iraq, because that's what Iran wants.
Yeah, and he certainly saw it. And, you know, so my perspective is getting there in 2004, spring of 2004, and you now have these organizations, these Shia organizations, having taken power, having gotten control of the ministries and begin to put their own people into the security forces. And then as that starts to spread and that starts to take, as we start to, you know, again, quote unquote, give Iraq back to the Iraqi government and the Iraqi people, you now have these organizations in positions of power. So now they are now in not just in the Shia areas in the south and Baghdad, in eastern Iraq, but now they're also in western Iraq and in northern Iraq. And they're filling positions that would have, if they were locally filled, would have been filled by local Sunnis. And so now you start to see some of that exclusion. You start to see some of that disenfranchisement that, you know, is now so readily observable. And is, of course, one of the major reasons for the civil war in Iraq. Where you didn't see it occur, of course, was up in Kurdistan, because the Kurds were at that point already semi-autonomous, and they were very, and also too, we favored the Kurds. And so we didn't push anything on the Kurds did not want. Remember, with the Sunni population, Paul Wolfowitz, who was Deputy Secretary of Defense and was primary architect of all this, and really was involved in kind of the day-to-day running from Washington, D.C. of the war, you know, his comparison, of course, was that the Sunnis were the same as the Nazis. And that led to the de-Ba'athification program, disbanding of the army, but also to you to see it in some of the things, the way he talked about them, the way he described them, that carried down to that the Sunnis were a bad people and couldn't be trusted, and they had to be excluded from power because of their sins when they were in power, which was just complete, you know, rubbish, really. I mean, the Ba'ath Party government was horrible, but to put it on one people, is a very simplified, wrong-headed way to look at it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and apparently Wolfowitz and them thought that Al-Qaeda terrorism was just basically a joke, a poster for them to exploit. They didn't care if bin Laden got away or not. They decided they would go and overthrow Saddam, who, you know, I saw this picture of him the other day. You usually always make fun of him because he's wearing a black beret. And I call him a secular atheist who worshipped only himself and might as well have lived in Paris. But anyway, I saw a picture of him the other day where he's wearing a fedora and an ascot and like this shiny three-piece suit. And and not one whisker on his chin, not one. And Paul Wolfowitz went and turned all of Sunni Stan into lawless jihadi Stan this last decade. Man, is there any way you could stay one more segment with me here and talk about the current state of the war? Or you got
to? Yeah, I can, of course.
Okay, great. Long break. We're back at 6 after. Top of the hour news and all that. It's Matthew Ho. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle, containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Sorry, I really didn't hear the bumper music until the very last second there in that last break. I didn't mean to botch that outro that bad, but Matthew Ho was kind enough to stay on the line with us here. Where we left off, I was talking about just how obvious it was that Saddam Hussein was not a bin Ladenite in any way. And the rise of all the bin Ladenites in his former territory since he was deposed because of the hubris of Paul Wolfowitz, his simplistic thinking, as Matthew described it there, of course, about, the Sunnis must go, even if that means a civil war that kills a million people and creates a generation of Al-Qaeda terrorists and the rest of this madness. But on the other hand, Paul Wolfowitz would say, hey, man, the secular fascists must go. Why is America backing secular fascists? Don't you know that's the difference between the neoconservatives and the realists? Is the realists, they don't mind blood at all. They don't care at all. They're just nation state men. But neoconservatives, we care. We want to make sure that we're doing the right thing. In fact, there's even a good anecdote. I don't know if it's true or not, but they say that Paul Wolfowitz helped convince Ronald Reagan to tell Ferdinand Marcos to beat it and end the fascist dictatorship in the Philippines and allow Corazon Aquino to come to power back in 1986 or 87 or whatever that was when I was a kid. Because he really believes in this democracy stuff, Matthew. So what about that?
You know, I think is what's amazing is that now in 2014, shortly it'll be 2015, more than a decade after these horrible mistakes and this purposeless war was launched, these guys like Wolfowitz still cling to it. They still won't acknowledge what a colossal failure it has been. And so there may be some truth in this notion that they are believers in democracy, that they are believers in this ideology, that they are that their purpose is a grand purpose to help liberate people. But it's absolute insanity. You're saying that a million dead Iraqis is worth the ability to go vote in a corrupt and rigged election. Because that's the reality of it. You have millions killed and wounded and the psychological harm. And now with the depleted uranium, exposure that is causing a mass amounts of birth defects and cancer rates. And so even if there was peace in Iraq, their children will be dying from their contaminated land and water. And the elections, this is the, depending upon what study you look at, whether it's from, Transparency International, or blanking on the name of the institution in the United States that does it as well. But this is the one of the most corrupt governments in the world, and it's rated as a not free, society. But somehow these guys, like Wolfowitz, Bush just said it, the other day on Face the Nation. He was interviewed by Bob Schieffer, and Bush said he had no regrets about the Iraq war because of the connections to 9/11 and Saddam's possession of chemical weapons. So they have in their head what occurred, and they have in their head that they were righteous and that they were serving some higher purpose. And I think what you get, Scott, beneath these gentlemen and ladies, what you get beneath them, or you get the cadre of loyalists. So what I would observe at levels of individuals at the National Security Council or in the CIA or State Department or at the Pentagon, these civilian appointees who were a couple levels down from the principals, so they were a couple levels down from the Secretary of State or from the Secretary of Defense in terms of their position. But they were so, or on the National Security Council, they were so loyal, they would refuse to acknowledge anything that didn't fit the narrative. So in the case of, say, Iraq with the Sunni insurgency in 2005-2006, I remember it just you couldn't say that the Sunni insurgency had nationalist reasons, that the vast bulk of the Sunni insurgency was fighting against occupation, was fighting against persecution, was fighting against being disenfranchised or usurped. They had to all be al-Qaeda terrorists. You know, I mean,
right, they were all Zarqawi. Every bombing was Zarqawi.
Exactly. And the reality was, you know, I mean, I clearly remember reading these, reading the reports, the classified reports, you know, and sitting in the State Department in 2005, reading our assessments of it. And at most 5% of the Sunni insurgency was al-Qaeda. What were these terrible jihadi terrorists who were coming to, take our freedom? And if they didn't, make it, they were going to get 72 virgins. You know, that kind of nonsense. But you couldn't bring that up. You would go to a briefing on the insurgency and it might list 10 or 15 reasons behind the insurgency. And none of it would say resistance to occupation, because that would go against the narrative and that would just, it was just not allowed. Just was not allowed. And so I think that's how you get individuals who have these notions, who have these beliefs in themselves and these ideas that they are the men who have been chosen to change history, or women to change history. But beneath them, all their advisors, all their assistants, all their workers are just these sycophants, these loyalists who won't acknowledge anything that doesn't fit what their boss's narrative is. And I think that's how that occurs in the Democratic administration as well. I saw the same thing in 2009 when the Obama administration came in. They had the same type of attitude that we're going to do this. We can do it better because we're not the Republicans. We know how to do it right. And if so, in Afghanistan, if you spoke about, look, most of the insurgency, the Taliban insurgency is a Pashtun nationalist phenomenon here, and they're fighting against occupation. And it's a continuation of the civil war. It's been going on for decades. You just weren't acknowledged because that didn't fit the narrative that we have to be there to stop another 9/11. We have to be there to keep ourselves safe, to defend our freedom. So I think that's how these policies start, but then are never adjusted or stopped or halted or even acknowledged as to be going off the rails. I mean, even like you said earlier, when we first started talking about the CNN report that the White House is now revisiting the Syria strategy. And I mean, I guarantee there are people in the White House who don't believe that Syria strategy is going wrong, that they believe it's going right. It just might need a few tweaks.
Yeah. And they're vowing to make it twice as stupid. I mean, they're, absolutely incredible. And I see what you're saying. It's, there could be a PhD kind of course in the public choice economics of the warfare state and how this all works, where every decision is made on every basis except what the average person would think these people's job is, the national interest, the short, medium, and long-term good, is something the slightest bit reasonable at all.
Yeah, to get back to your point earlier about the need for chaos and a need for war. And I do believe that exists in Washington, D.C. And you see it in the think tanks. You see it among the defense industry. You see among some in the intelligence community and the defense community. Like I said, I haven't seen the hearings today, but the last time we had these hearings in the Senate on Syria, the graphics that were provided, the maps that were provided by the Institute for the Study of War. Not by the Department of Defense, not by the Central Intelligence Agency, not by the Department of State, but by an outside think tank that is funded completely by the defense industry.
Yeah, and which is run by the Kagans.
It's run by the
Kagans. The ones who got us into this mess. Robert, who got us into Iraq, and his brother Fred, who got us into the surge.
Yes. And so you see that as well. So then you start to see, well, okay, these people who are in power, who have who have these notions of the righteousness of their decisions, that it's going to work out because of who we are and because of who they are. Well, now they're emboldened and they're supported by these PhDs, these academics, these think tank policy experts who are financially driven by the war. So it does. It kind of comes full circle in terms of how this works.
Yep. All right. Well, thanks very much for your time. I'm sorry. I wanted to ask you even more about the current situation there, but that just leaves us open to having you back soon. So appreciate it, Matthew.
Scott. All right. Thanks, Scott.
That's Matthew Ho. He's at the Huffington Post. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, you guys. Man, I wanted to keep another segment, but I also got to talk about these other things. And I got Marcy Wheeler coming up, and I'm just crunched for time, and I got to cut him loose. But, yeah, the Iraq War. Had a few things more to ask him there. I will say that this morning, Hagel and Dempsey testified before the House of Representatives, and they talked about vast numbers of troops would be required. Iraq needs 80,000 good troops to retake lost territory. 80,000, meaning Shiite militiamen. And then with American special forces and air power help, these men are supposed to take back Mosul and Tikrit and Fallujah and Bakuba and all the predominantly Sunni parts of Iraq. And then what? Bringing the Shiite militiamen to do that? Or where they're going to train up 80,000 moderates. Is that it? 80,000 moderates? America's policy is to put the Badr Corps back in charge. Those guys are every bit the savages that the Islamic State are, only on the other side. And so how's that supposed to work out? You know, the entire story of the Iraq War, you could go day by day, week by week, month by month, year by year, and measure the horrific consequences of every single thing that they did. And watch how it all caused the next thing to happen, which was caused the reaction, which led to the excuse for the suicide attack that blew up the mosque, that made everything worse and worse and worse and worse the whole time that America was occupying that place. And as bad as Fallujah was, they didn't send all Shiite militia men with an agenda to attempt to drive the Mujahideen out of there. I mean, the whole thing was absolute slaughter and an absolute catastrophe in every way. But God, at least they weren't outright just bringing the Badr Brigade with them on that one 10 years ago. Anyway, they were fighting for the Badr Brigade in a sense, but not like what they're saying their plan is. The whole thing makes no sense. And when you read Jeff Stein's story today, he has quotes from 5 or 6 or 7 different CIA agents saying, "We suck at this. We can't vet these guys. There is no vetting." I'll tell you what vetting is. You got one real expert at it can do it well, but then, nah, that never works out either. What? This is the policy, to train up 5,000 moderates in Syria in a volunteer Mujahideen war. Whereas Patrick Coburn has reported for years, all sides, all factions he talks to all love the September 11th attack and hate America and identify with the goals of bin Laden, etc. The only split between Baghdadi and Golani, the Islamic State and al-Qaeda in Syria there, is over who's taking orders from who. But otherwise, they're all the same. Al-Nusra is the same as ISIS. And all the so-called Free Syrian Army factions are maybe slight shades better. But take a look at the examples where the Northern Storm Brigade, John McCain's friends, and those guys sold Stephen Sotloff to ISIS. And before that, that same brigade had kidnapped a bunch of Shiite pilgrims, civilians from Lebanon. And before that, they had talked to
to Time magazine, and their leader had admitted that he was a veteran of the Iraq War, where he had fought the Americans. You can find it right now at Time magazine. Just type in Time, Northern Storm. Just type in Northern Storm Brigade. It'll come right up. Time magazine, before John McCain went and palled around with these guys, there's their leader saying, yes, I'm a veteran in the Iraq War, where I went and fought the Americans in their occupation there. These are the moderates. Or then there's the Al-Farouk Brigade, who said, we don't want to persecute the Alawites and the Shiites and the Christians and the Druze and the whatever, man. We want to hold elections and everybody get along. Oh, except there's their leader on video eating a dead soldier's heart. These are the moderates that America's training up to be their FSA. Oh, and all the other groups, the ones that don't just outright turn all their TOW missiles and the rest of their money and weapons over to the jihadists, are killed by them. This is absolutely crazy. I've said this before, but it's brilliant. It's very simple and true and obvious. But I'm going to say it a million times because nobody else is saying it. And I don't care if anybody gives me credit either. Go ahead and pretend you made it up. But the giant spin about the Iraq War was, yeah, if only we hadn't debothified the government and kicked all the Sunnis and dissolved the army, kicked all the Sunni leadership out of the government. Well, that may have been inevitable anyway once you got rid of Saddam, because you had the Ayatollah Khamenei saying the Shia are taking power. One man, one vote. You say democracy, we say we're going to rule this place and you're going to help us take the capital, punk. And at that point, they were in the driver's seat and George Bush was Iran and Shiism's servant at that point. But it does make sense that abolishing the army and debothifying the government certainly dissolved any Ba'athist control over the Sunni areas of Iraq. Again, the Shiite religious the Shiite Iranian and American backed factions weren't interested in dominating Sunnistan all along anyway. They didn't really care. But so who was left to rule them except the local insurgency, which ended up, allying with Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and which ended up turning all of Sunnistan into Jihadistan. Well, so that is universally recognized as a giant blunder of that war. And yet what is proposed, what is unanimously agreed upon in Washington, D.C. right now? That that's exactly what America should do in Syria when their Saddam Hussein, Bashar al-Assad, is in the middle of a war against Al-Qaeda in Syria. I mean, think about it like this. Remember how there was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq at all before the war? What if there had been a Sunni-based religious Islamist bin Ladenite insurgency against Saddam Hussein's secular fascist rule? His Sunnism, officially his sectarian identity notwithstanding. Would that have been a good time to overthrow him? If he'd been in the middle of trying to put down a bin Ladenite insurgency, would George Bush have taken bin Laden's side in that one then? Even? That's what they're proposing for Syria right now. Here we have not just a secular Ba'athist, but he's an Alawite, which is a kind of Shia, who has every incentive to keep Al-Qaeda down, and it has been fighting them for 2 years, 2.5, 3 years. And America is proposing that the way to get rid of the Islamic State is to get rid of Assad first? I made this analogy in the introduction to the interview with Matthew Ho there. It is like saying, okay, the Russians or the French decided they were going to solve America's civil war between the North and the South. And the French decided that the real enemy are the Nazi racialist murderer, regime of the South. And that's the real threat. But we can't fight them until first we overthrow Abraham Lincoln and the Republicans in Washington, D.C. Only then can we fight the Confederacy. Does that make any sense? That's what they're saying they have to do. We must defeat the Islamic State, bin Laden incarnate, ruling a caliphate, but we have to get rid of the secular, fascist, Ba'athist, clean-shaven chin dictator who's fighting them at the same damn time. Huh?
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And sorry about the hammering and banging in the background. They're working on the house next door. I'm not sure how much of that's coming through, but I'll try to leave my mic off through most of this interview and spare you in case it's a problem. Our next guest on the show has got the X-ray eyes, as my old high school history teacher used to call them. It's Marcy Wheeler. You know how when you read a law, you go, huh? Well, she doesn't do that. She reads the law, and she knows exactly what it is that they're saying there, and she knows exactly how to find the reference where they changed as to shall or whatever it is that changes everything when they do an update of another thing kind of thing. She's just got magical powers along those lines. You show her something called the USA Freedom Act, and she'll tell you why it's no such thing. Why is it no such thing, Marcy? Welcome back to the show. Sister, what happened? Well, I'm going to blame the NSA. NSA, that was your fault. There you go. I don't know what happened, but I got her back now. Hi, Marcy. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I am good. Yourself?
I'm doing wonderful. I was just telling people about your near magical ability to understand what legalese means. Certainly, I don't know if other, you know, trained people are as good as you at it or something, but I don't know any normal mortals who could read the USA Freedom Act and just immediately see all the giant holes in it and problems with it the way that you can and do. But I sure give you the benefit of the doubt on this. Why I don't support the USA Freedom Act, supposed NSA reform, the backlash, the result of the Snowden revelations. Marcy, tell me, what's the problem?
There are several problems. What happened was, the government has had a problem getting all of the phone records that they want. And part of that is that they don't necessarily have access to all VOIP calls, like the one that we're on right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's just as well. They shouldn't spy on us when we're talking on the radio. But they also had lost access to a lot of cell phone calls. And it's not entirely clear why. I think it's partly because Verizon provides its records. This is a very well-informed hypothesis. Verizon provides its records to the government differently than AT&T and Sprint. And therefore, the government was having problems demanding certain things from Verizon. And so Verizon's only obligated under the law to provide existing business records. They don't keep a lot of these records, and therefore the government was losing access to any cell phone records that were coming across Verizon's networks. And, mm-hmm. and they're one of the two key backbones providers in the United States. So they were losing all that access. And then there are smaller providers, and especially providers that do a lot of burner phones. So they needed to find a way to get access to that. So that's actually the point of USA Freedom Act. It's not, the government decided that they thought it was a good idea to get the phone records out of their hands, not because they wanted to get the phone records out of their hands, but because they were increasingly running into problems getting all the records they want. So if you talk to certain honest people in D.C. or the Maryland area, they'll tell you that they sort of see this as a fair trade-off, that they're getting more coverage. So in fact, more Americans are going to be subject to this spying potentially in exchange for having to let the providers keep their own records. So that's really what's going on.
Well,
and then in the process, huh?
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm taking notes. Well, go ahead.
No. Okay. So in the process of that, and the NGOs and the reformers and everyone who wants to change this because it's absolutely crazy for the government to hold some significant subset of all of our phone records, they all, you know, couldn't get in their mind, the other parts of the program that are abusive. So, for example, no one is fixing what happens when you get sucked up. Like, I'm 2 degrees away from Edward Snowden, so it's very easy to envision getting sucked up. Once you're sucked up for life. You know, you're in the NSA's maw, subject to whatever they want, you know, whatever analytical stuff they want to do with your metadata for life. And that, to me, is even more abusive. But the reformers were just like, we got to get the phone records out of the government hands. We got to get the phone records out of the government hands. And that made them very susceptible to that put them in a very weak position. They didn't realize they were giving the government something the government needed, and so they negotiated from a weak position. They didn't think through some of the other programs. So just as an example, both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal have reported that the same provision that is used to collect all of our phone records are used to collect, for example, wire transfer records. So all of the Western Union wire transfers that go overseas, they're also collecting that. And they use it in very much the same way. They collect it. If they get a RAS approved identifier, they're allowed to go in and see anybody who's 2 degrees of separation from that alleged terrorist. And you can see why they'd want it, because that would allow them to figure out who was transferring money to alleged terrorists. But the way the bill is written, it only affects communications. It doesn't affect other stuff, even though the entire language of the underlying bill is called the tangible things, you know, so there's a bunch of other stuff that they can collect with this law, that no one thought to fix. So it doesn't fix a number of dragnets. The other thing it doesn't fix is the FBI has, or at least had as recently as 2012, a bulky PRT, pen register program, which I suspect is the use, you know what stingrays are? That mm-hmm. there are these kind of fake cell towers that collect, that ping to cell phones and therefore are able to locate people. We know the FBI uses that all the time in the criminal context, and there's very good reason to suspect that they do individualized PRTT orders to go after individual terrorists, if you will, in the United States. But there's some kind of bulky program under that law, and I suspect it's a bulky location program that they share the data with the NSA. And again, given the definitions of the bill, pinging, location finding isn't included, you know, under bulky programs, or, and this is true for both of these, they're not included in the transparency provisions. So in other words, everyone's like, well, we'll know if they're doing bulky provisions, but we'll know if they're continuing to do bulk programs because it'll show up in the transparency provisions, except that both pings, both location finders, and anything that's not a communication, you know, an email or a phone call, are excluded from the transparency provisions. So that's a big part of the problem with them.
Wow.
Not the only one, but a big part.
Right. And now, so, okay, I can see, and we'll go back over some of this, make sure I understand you right, but on the civil liberties groups lining up behind this thing, I can see how, you know, maybe they just didn't bring their best set of eyes with them to tear through that thing the way that you do. But so now that they've committed themselves to this, but I know that you've been bringing their attention, or attempting to bring ACLU and other groups' attentions to the flaws in this thing for many months now. And I know that they're honest brokers on this. They're trying to be right. So maybe it's a little embarrassing, but is there any movement from the endorsees of this so-called reform on the good guys' side?
Look, I think there's a lot of people who are now who have realize, I mean, for a long time, I think people just said, no, that doesn't make sense. We've had conversations. What you're saying is in the bill isn't in the bill, but they didn't go back and read the bill. So it took me a while to get people to go back and read the actual language of the bill. And then they started going, oh, you're right about that. And you're right about that. And, you know, I don't need them to publicly, you know, get a front page New York Times article saying,
sure,
you know, she was fucking right, as Judy Miller was. that's a little joke. She wasn't. I think people are trying to see whether they can improve it with some reforms. Another really, really easy reform that they should make is the way immunity in other bills, other laws like this is written, the provider has to be engaged in good faith fulfillment of an order.
Mm-hmm.
Here they took that good faith language out. So long as a provider is following an order, they have immunity. So even if the providers do something they know is illegal, they would still have immunity.
All right. Which they have de facto anyway, but yeah, very important they're passing. All right, the great Marcy Wheeler, emptywheel.net. We'll be right back, y'all. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all his stocks while the getting is good.
investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm on the line with Marcy Wheeler, EmptyWheel.net. That's her blog, where she goes through and explains the truth of these very complicated subjects like this NSA reform, the USA Freedom Act, the Freedom Act, as she's called it, for many months now. So I think first and foremost, I want to go back to the first kind of thing you're explaining there, Marcy, that if I understood it correctly, you're saying Verizon is in the habit of not keeping all the records or not keeping them all long enough to turn them over to the NSA under, you know, this, that, or the other authority kind of thing. And that the NSA is basically fixing that problem by, it sounds like not just, you know, there's a kind of lame reform bill going through. It sounds like it's a cynical exploitation of the backlash against the NSA, that they're just writing it to put their own language in there that says that, oh yeah, no, we won't keep the data anymore. We'll just keep it on AT&T and Verizon servers, which of course makes the point virtually moot, if not 100% moot. But then in that sense, they'll be forcing Verizon to now keep all those records that before they couldn't have access to. So this whole thing is really just amounts to a con, it sounds like, is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's sort of what I'm saying. Now, let me be really clear that my theory about Verizon is just a really well-educated guess. There's a lot of reason, there's a lot of evidence to support it, but it's just still, I haven't proven it yet. It's important that this bill does not require Verizon to keep their records any longer, and Verizon, I think, would sue if they were required to do so. That would I think really undermine the underlying claims that this is the third party doctrine, because that's already being undermined in courts. But you can't say, well, it's okay for you to get phone records that are 5 years old from Verizon, because that's just the ordinary course of doing business, because Verizon doesn't keep those records for 5 years. So Verizon won't have to keep the records for longer. But the bill requires pretty broad. It basically, in the same way that PRISM requires fairly broad cooperation from the internet providers, this bill requires the same from the phone providers. Now, there's very good reason to believe AT&T and Sprint are already providing that cooperation under a paid contract for the FBI. So in other words, I don't know if you remember the Hemisphere program, where the DEA and FBI can go to AT&T and find burner phones and find details about who's been hanging out with whom. So AT&T, that's the kind of thing that I think Verizon is going to be asked to do. They just have chosen, and again, this is a guess, they have chosen not to make it a key part of their business to be a spy for the government. Whereas AT&T, that's how they got started. So they're happy to do that. They're not as sound a business as Verizon. I mean, this is a guess. Again, I can't guarantee this, but we know, for example, that one of the phone providers stopped providing phone records, NSLs, National Security Letter records, to the FBI through an earlier contract provision. It's not 100% clear that it's Verizon, but there's a lot of reason to believe that it's Verizon that backed out in 2009. So, those are some of the reasons why I think this is going on. Mm-hmm. And this would, basically put Verizon into either having to itself cooperate more, intimately with the government, or to work with a contractor who would also get immunity and also get paid and also get these broad orders, so that a contractor would provide it. But in any case, I think that's sort of what would happen with the telecoms. Now, there are other things in this bill that I have concerns about. I think the transparency provisions actually are counterproductive. I think that there's an emergency provision now where if, they still have all the phone records, And if the government wants to go and use that in an emergency without getting pre-approval from the court, they then have to submit an application after the fact. And if the court rejects their application and says, you know, you had no business getting records from this person, you know, you basically were going after this person just for their speech. Right now, the court has the authority to make them get rid of the records. And under the bill, the court wouldn't have that authority. And I think that's nonsense, especially because the most recent Dragnet order was adding things to the emergency provisions, which makes me believe the government has already been caught abusing them, using these emergency provisions to go after people for their protected speech. So it's stuff like that. One final really important thing that I think needs fixed is the bill adds an advocate. And the advocate is supposed to be somebody who will tell the court it's engaging in completely bogus theories, right? The advocate is supposed to say, you can't claim that relevant to means all. That's nonsense.
So sort of a pseudo public defender to argue against the government's position in the secret FISA court, you're saying?
Right. For all of these exotic requests, you would have an advocate in there at least to present a different side. And James Clapper, when he said, I'm on board with USA Freedom Act, said, I'm really glad that you aren't changing ex parte proceedings in the court. Well, we just saw, we got all of the records from the Yahoo challenge, which goes back to 2007, 2008, which was ex parte. And what we've seen in that is that the government withheld stuff. In fact, Bill Leonard, who used to be in charge of classification for the entire government, I showed him some of the stuff they withheld from Yahoo, and he said, oh, that's a bullshit, classification standard. You know, they basically were withholding stuff that made it clear the government was misbehaving. And the government actually wasn't even giving the court everything they needed for that Yahoo challenge. So we now know how badly ex parte proceedings go. We know that, James Clapper thinks he's gonna still operate under ex parte proceedings. And so that aspect of the advocate needs to be strengthened for it to do what it should do. And there's no reason it shouldn't.
Right. All right. Now I want to ask you about what you wrote here at emptywheel.net. You say, passing this law may moot court decisions in three different circuit courts where they actually are starting to do the right thing, and this is going to pull the rug out from under them. Is that right?
Yeah. So right after the Snowden declarations, everyone turned around and sued. So the ACLU sued in New York, and they are both Verizon Wireless and Verizon Wired subscribers. Larry Klayman of Freedom Watch sued in D.C., and EFF sued on behalf of a bunch of probably targeted entities in San Francisco. And two of those, the ACLU and the Klayman case, have both been heard at the circuit court already. Klayman didn't do a great job, I have to say, in the circuit court. But that court has precedents that should make this patently illegal. So that court should be really friendly to hearing his suit. And besides, he's just trying to sustain the favorable decision he got from Judge Leon at the district level. In New York, the ACLU case, the lawyer in that just absolute slam dunk argument. And they ended up in that ACLU case pulling the same panel or two judges from the same panel that had ruled over Amnesty v. Clapper, which was the PRISM challenge that ACLU launched on behalf of Amnesty back in 2008, which got thrown out because the government lied, and those judges are still pissed about being lied to. So they're two of the most favorable judges in the country, because the last time the government was before them with a surveillance program, the government lied. And so these judges, I think, would like to find a way to make all this surveillance more reasonable. And then the last case will be heard before the D.C. Circuit. I'm sorry, the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco. Actually, the plaintiff is an Idaho woman. I'm not actually sure where the hearing's going to be, but regardless, it's the Ninth Circuit, which tends to be somewhat more liberal on these issues than even the D.C. Circuit. So you would have a circuit split almost certainly. And then the Supreme Court would have to rule on whether the government can keep all these records and contact chain them with all these other records. And then we might finally figure out where the limits of, you know, all this mosaic intelligence collecting is. And I think once, but the easy way out for all these courts is for Congress to have passed a bill. So once Congress passes a bill, these courts are all going to go, well, this program doesn't exist anymore. So your challenge is dismissed as moot.
Right. Oh, and so it goes. Well, thanks very much for your time on the show again, Marcy. Great to talk to you.
Absolutely. Take care.
Great work you do there. That's the heroic Marcy Wheeler, everybody. She's at emptywheel.net. This piece is Why I Don't Support the USA Freedom Act. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richmond, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richmond, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.